Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the fastest growing and largest segment of society, to those of you who have come to realize that all of the world's religious, political, military, economic, even academic and media institutions have become counterproductive, that they cannot be fixed. Our phone number, if you would like to join us during this discussion, is toll free. It's 877-300-7645. I want to actually begin with a story in the news, even though we have Kirk with us this morning. It reads as follows. The Islamic State fighters have looted and bulldozed the ancient Assyrian city of Nimrud, the Iraqi government said in their latest assault on some of the world's greatest archaeological and cultural treasures. Why do you suspect that I shared that story? Do you think it's to point out that the Islamic State is destructive of history? Or perhaps there's another reason?
Well, that's the obvious one would be to wipe out the thing. I'm not sure where.
Yeah. And by the way, Muslims have to do that because the history that is depicted in the Quran is all wrong. There is no history in the Quran that is accurate. Muhammad was questioned by rabbis when he arrived in Yathrib about his credentials, claiming to be the messenger of God. And so he was asked three questions that if he was even informed, he would have known the answer to. And he meant, talk about just stupid. He has Alexander the Great being a Muslim prophet. That's kind of weird since he was claimed to be the son of Zeus and was a practitioner of the Greek religion. Alexander the Great, rather than going to Egypt and to Persia, no, he didn't go in those directions. He went to the sun, and he found an extraterrestrial community that was living around the sun, and he preached Islam to them. And this is the place where the sun goes to sleep at night in a muddy spring. It has the Pharaoh of Egypt threatening Abraham with crucifixion more than 1,000 years before crucifixion was even invented as a form of punishment, and the Egyptians never engaged in crucifixion. It has the two cities that it constantly mentions that Allah terrorized in Arabia that were mighty cities with great architectural buildings and shrines and the like, and of course, they never existed. Everything historic about the Quran is erroneous. So do Muslims have to erase their history? The worst part of the Islamic history, Kirk, is the fact that Islam created such a monster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Arabs before Islam were peaceable people. They were eked out a meager living in what was the most inhospitable terrain in the world. They were wholly ignorant because no civilization wanted to conquer Arabia. Why would you want to? I mean, it's like trying to say lay claim to a cat's litter box. Why would you want to? So the Egyptians didn't, the Persians didn't, the Babylonians didn't, the Assyrians didn't, the Greeks didn't. No one went there. And so it was wholly ignorant. They didn't even have a written language. And they didn't come with a written language until the 8th century CE. And yet they were surrounded by the countries that had the earliest written languages.
Mm-hmm.
So wholly ignorant, peaceable, eked out a trade. No historical record of of Arabs leaving Arabia to go plunder and wage war on anyone.
No.
And then Muhammad creates Islam. And all of a sudden, there is no productivity. The only business is a crime syndicate, thievery and plunder. They become the world's most violent and ruthless barbarians. And they're promoting a religion that's so stupid, errant historically, errant scientifically, grossly immoral that it hurts. And it just destroys everything it touches. It's only good at being bad. And so what Muslims had to do is to create this impression that the time before Islam was even worse. So they've revised their history. Now, there's no written documents. There's no archaeological evidence. There's no even histories from surrounding countries to support any of this. But they came up with the preposterous notion that before Islam, Arabs were ignorant and that they were immoral, and that post-Islam, they're no longer ignorant or immoral by comparison. So revisionist history, destroying history as it actually was, is essential to Muslims. Because one of the things the Quran says is that, you know, by your commitment to Islam, Islam will be proven victorious because it will be shown that Islam is superior to any other religion. You know, Allahu Akbar.
Yeah,
so if if there was a civilization, for example, in Babylon, and there was, that was vastly superior to anything that Islam has ever created long before Islam, it proves that these two revisionist history aspects of Islam are false. Mm-hmm. And so they have to destroy Nimrod. Now, the other reason I wanted to share that with you is that are you familiar with the name Nimrod? Ever heard that before?
Oh, yeah. Became the sun god after he...
Right, Yahweh specifically mentions Nimrod. I talked about him being a very aggressive individual, striving against God. Nimrod is, Nen is sun in the Akkadian language, and associates Nimrod with the Babylon. And so it tells a story of this man and his life and his influence. It's the oldest record of him existing for many thousands of years thereafter. All traces were lost, and then, in archaeological discoveries here in the last 100 years, they found, in fact, there was a Nimrod, and they found the city that was his capital.
Right.
Every notion that is presented in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is accurate historically, both past history and future history. There is a God who can be trusted, and there is a wannabe God who cannot. I think that's fairly significant. Of course, that was missed by the Reuters writer who took it upon himself to tell this story.
Well, if you're going to make a living out of lying, you better kill all the truth. I mean, shut down the library, shut down everything.
Yep.
That's the way you do it.
Yep.
Hitler had to destroy his hometown, because they'd find out his grandparents might be Jewish.
The Christians, the Byzantines, are blamed for burning down the library, for example, at Alexandria, which was the greatest library in the ancient world. Not so. The destruction of that library was by Muslims. Boko Haram actually means education is harmful.
I didn't know.
In an Islamic country, under Sharia law, women cannot be educated at all, and men can only be educated in two subjects.
Sharia law. Huh.
What do you think the two subjects are that a man can be educated in?
The Quran and Sharia law.
Well, the Quran, Sharia law, Hadith, all the same. Jihad.
Jihad, of course.
How to kill people. Yeah, that's the only other thing they can be educated on. It is just astonishing that people stay so naive, so unaware of all of this. And it particularly is as important as it all is. All right, we were going to return to Devarim. Not Devarim, Bamidbar. Devarim means words, and Bamidbar is in the wilderness. There is a similarity between those two names, and that the Hebrew word for wilderness, Midbar, is a derivative of Dabar, which is the Hebrew word for word. And all the men adds before Bamidbar, it adds without. So the translation of Midbar in Hebrew is desolate place, lifeless place. That's why it's called the wilderness or the desert. Lifeless place, desolate or lifeless place. And the actual name is a derivative of a compound, men without, and the bar, word. So you're lifeless without the word. Always interesting to study the formation of Hebrew words.
Wow.
All right, here's the here's where we were in the text. Unless you've got something you'd like to begin with,
I'm following along. We were at 624 to I think where we left off.
Yeah, that's right. And what we had read is that in the King James, it's the Lord bless thee and keep thee, and in the actual text of the Torah, it reads Yahweh. He wants to kneel down in love, to continually bless you, desiring to lift you up forever. For your benefit. And he has decided to actually and continually focus upon you. So the King James added a definite article, the, when there is no definite article anywhere in that sentence. They replaced Yahweh's name with Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two ways to communicate Lord in Hebrew. One that appears in the Torah, the other that does not. Baal appears in the Torah. It's the primary Hebrew word for Lord. It is not a reference to God. It's a reference to Hasatan, the adversary. Adon, which is the other Hebrew word for Lord, is the basis of Adonis. You know, Adonai is my Lord. Adonis is the name of the Greek son of the sun and a sun god. And Adon does not appear anywhere in the Torah. Edon, however, does. And Edon, written similarly, just vocalized differently, is used throughout the Torah, always in connection with the upright pillar of the tabernacle and the tent of the witness. It's the vertical beam that holds the tent up of Yahweh's home, and allows it to be expanded over a greater area, making it secure. That is the Edom. So they had no right to replace Yahweh's name with Satan's title. Returning now to Shattering Mist and Numbers 6:24, where the King James says, "The Lord bless thee and keep thee." They only got one word right. They got three words twisted.
Mm-hmm.
The does not exist in the text. They added it. Lord absolutely, positively doesn't exist. That's Satan's title and name. They eliminated Yahweh's name. And then they have bless. But with bless, they forgot its primary meaning. Yeah, they forgot its primary meaning. Blessing is a derivative of the attitude associated with Barak, which is be on your knees in love to lift someone up. It's Barak is always the depiction of a father lifting up a son or a daughter, setting them on their feet. That's what Yahweh most wants to do with us, to lift us up, put us on our feet. And so they missed all of that. And we talked yesterday about the stem that Barak was written in, which is the peel, which means that the subject, Yahweh, influences the object, which is you and I.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't.
Missed all of that.
They ignored that, didn't they? They missed the fact that it was written in the imperfect, which means it's ongoing. They missed that too, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
And they missed the fact that it was written in the jussive, which is a third-person volition. And so this is Yahweh's will.
Sorry. Right.
They missed that too, didn't they?
Uh-huh.
So, it's not, so
right, too.
They got the conjunction right. And.
And.
Yeah, they did. They got the conjunction right. Does shamar mean keep?
No, sir.
Particularly as it's presented here. Keep means here would be to keep you contained, to keep you, from doing something. It's like when I was a kid, I kept an apple.
Get you out of trouble.
Yeah, for, keep you out of trouble
That's restraining.
Right. You know, if you were a kept woman, that's not a good thing.
Not a good
thing. Right? You know, to keep in, you know, if for example, you take me out to lunch and I keep my wallet in my back pocket, I'm restricting myself from from contributing.
Probably not to take you out to lunch, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I don't want to be kept. I don't want to be a kept individual. I've had friends who were men who were kept.
Uh-huh.
You know, who realized that, you know, there were women who typically widows who had lots of money and we could provide them with a really nice place to live and lots of nice toys and they didn't have to work. Being kept just isn't my thing. I like to contribute to a relationship. If you do, if you take me out to lunch, you'll have to fight with me to keep me from paying the bill.
Don't worry.
Yeah, you know, I like paying the bill. I do. You know what? When you know, if we engage in work, even when I have my landscapers here, I dig in. I don't just supervise. I'm right there, you know, working with them. I like to contribute. I think contributing is fun. Yeah, it's fun. And so to be kept, you know, a lord keeps watch over and control over and keeps his subjects in line.
Mm-hmm.
This is very much of a satanic concept here.
You know, I have a 26 Bible translation, so it has mm-hmm. 26 of the English Bibles, and it differentiates which ones, it prints which ones are slightly different.
Right.
I have six under this, under the King James, 6:24.
Uh-huh.
And every one of them, there's one, of course, that does use Yahweh, but then he says, bless thee, and then he continues on and keep thee, so he blew everything else. And even though he got,
and it probably doesn't have Yahweh, it just says Yahweh.
No, it's Yahweh, yes, the other one. And you go through these six that are identified as being slightly different, and all of them have missed it profoundly. I mean, this is so deep, and this is so shallow,
right?
The true translation. So, I mean, I don't know where you could send somebody to find it.
Right.
You know, without yeah.
The concept of blessing in the peel stem, injusive mood, imperfect conjugation of Barak, of this attitude of God, because he's the subject here, Yahweh, getting down on his knees, wanting, deciding to do so, to get down on his knees because he loves us and he wants to lift us up. And forever, for our benefit, which is what all the moods, the stem, the conjugation conveys. Man, that is so powerful. That just is transformative. It makes God someone you want to run up to and embrace and hug and be very comfortable with, knowing that he has our best interests.
And thank you for caring.
Yeah, thank you for caring. Thank you for helping. So here we are with number 624. The King James essentially got everything wrong. Since you can't give them credit for the these, because it's simple you. And you can't give them credit for the bless because it's way too inadequate, and that's the tertiary meaning of the word. And you can't give them credit for keep because that their implication is the opposite. What this really says, it's reciprocal, is that if you are observant and pay attention to Yahweh,
mm-hmm.
he's going to pay attention to you.
When we went to break, I was just looking at the three words in front of me, and you add the word debar in there, and you pretty much got the whole Torah, the heart of the Torah, encapsulated in those four words. If you add the debar,
yeah,
you've got Yahweh, the picture of him, and if you hear these words, the real words, instead of all the other stuff in the English translations, you hear these words, and you, if you're fortunate enough to put them down in pictograph in the original language, and you understand what those things mean. The wealth of images and meanings
right.
should just overwhelm you. I mean, it's right. just. And
let's talk about them. You can add debar, because in the introduction to this, wasn't debar? I know it was mm-hmm. used at least twice, but I think it was used three times. and where, in addition to the three times dabar was stated, which is the Hebrew word for spoke or communicate or statement, mm-hmm. or most yeah. importantly, word as a noun.
Mm-hmm. Word, yeah.
And in addition to the multiple uses of dabar, you also had at least two uses of amar, which is the Hebrew word for assert, say, promise, answer, declare.
Mm-hmm.
So,
we had la amar,
La amar. Yeah, the shepherd's staff to approach the shepherd with the individual who is provides protection and leadership, cleansing and renewing life-giving nature of water for an observant individual, for amar, la amar, and dabars.
What struck me is you don't have to, and for the people who are just beginning this journey,
mm-hmm.
you don't have to learn the entire lexicon or the entire dictionary over there of words. I mean, just start with some of the real, the most meaningful, obviously, is name and what he's doing and what he wants us to do, which is Shemar Torah.
Reinforcement's always a good thing. So let's start with Dabar, since it was used multiple times to introduce this. Dabar tells us what?
We had a D, which is an open door.
Mm-hmm.
We had that was a delete.
Right.
We had fumbling around here trying to find my
B open. Is B is the
B. Oh yeah, B is the West is the family home.
Right.
You had the Rosh, which is the head of a person, the one that mm-hmm. engages with their senses. They think, they consider, they look, hear.
Right. Exactly. Rosh means head in Hebrew. It means first and foremost.
First and foremost.
And Beth, the second letter, means family and home, in Hebrew, and it's depicted as a family home. The Rosh is depicted as a head. It means head, first, top, best. And then the Dabar is depicted as, certainly the Daleth is depicted as the doorway to a home, and it means door.
Right.
So, and no surprise here. So, when we're dealing with the word of Yahweh, we know he's speaking about the doorway to his home for individuals who prioritize being observant, closely examining and carefully considering. That's what the word is all about. That's a pretty good definition. How about Yahweh? So what does it tell us? It's a wonderful summary of the Torah right there in Dabar.
Well, it is. And then, of course, with Yahweh, the most meaningful name, name his renown. He starts out with a depiction of what he is most like. He's reaching down with his arm, a yod, with an open hand, reaching down to lift us up.
Right.
You have the hey, the following letter is the hey, which is an H sound, and it's a person standing up, reaching up, beholding this great thing.
Can I correct you just on one thing?
Certainly.
The hey really isn't the H sound. It's a vowel. It's the ah sound.
That's right.
To shape the sound of the ah, in English, we would add the H at the end of an A to get that, because there's a lot of different vocalizations of the letter A, long and short, and, you know, variations of it. The H at the end, in fact, I was looking at a word written in Spanish, although it did not have the H at the end of the Spanish word to depict how to say the word in English, they put an H at the end of the A just to get the ah sound. But the hey is a verb, and
it's A-H or E-H.
Yeah, it's the A-H sound, which is a verb. All a verb means is an open mouth sound. A vowel is an open mouth sound. A consonant is a closed mouth sound. Mm-hmm. There's no great mystery to any of this. But the all four letters in Yahweh's name, two of which are repeated, all are vowels. It's Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
The mouth is open because he's talking to us.
Yeah. I'm just used to calling the letter "hey," and
And if you read, by the way, if you read a scholarly Hebrew tome, they will tell you that there are no vowels in Hebrew.
Oh yeah.
That there are two silent letters. And that all the other letters are consonants. And because they're consonants, no one knows how to pronounce them.
Yeah.
Now, the problem with that is, and this is the problem with scholars, is that the most revered ancient Hebrew scholar of all time amongst the scholarly group is Josephus, mm-hmm. who was the Jewish cleric who turns traitor when the Romans were pummeling Israel and joined sides with the Romans to spare his own life. Then he went to Rome and he wrote the Antiquities, the history of the Yahudim, the Jews. And he, in talking about Yahweh's name, says the four vowels.
Yeah.
And then if you don't want to take Josephus's name, and he's the scholar of scholars in terms of ancient Hebrew, then all you got to do is look at the Hebrew lexicon. Look at the words that are written with the Yod, the He, and the Waw, and see how the Yod, the He, and the Waw are pronounced. And what you find is that a Yod, He, Waw, He, it'd be pronounced Yahweh. There's no mystery to this.
Yeah.
Use your eyes, be observant, think about it, and you will absolutely come to the conclusion, yes, these are all vowels. This is how they're pronounced.
Well, why would you need, after so many thousand years, why do you need some vowel points to tell you how to pronounce something? I mean, unless you're trying to hide something.
Doesn't the Torah say in the Devarim words that fathers are encouraged, fathers and mothers, parents, we are encouraged to recite the Torah when we wake up, when we go to bed,
and go to bed,
when we're standing up, when we're sitting down, and to our children so that we all know it by rote?
Yeah.
Now, how would you do that on a written scroll? Because he says this, the Torah is a written scroll, because he says, I want it always associated with the Ark of the Covenant and its mercy seat. It's always to be next to it, always associated with it. How would you recite this if there were no vowels? If it required the vowel pointing, which took place 2,500 years later.
And how did Yahweh tell him if he couldn't speak it? I mean, he sat right there on the mountain and told him and read it to him.
When Moshe was writing down, God's initial conversation with him and said, you may tell them that my name is Yahweh. That is my only name and the only name that I want to be used and remembered regarding me. Right. How would he have written Yahweh down to reflect the what Yahweh said?
I put the vowel point over here, or did I put it over yonder?
Over yonder. Uh-huh. Over 2,500 years yonder. That's why you.
Some of this is too stupid for words.
I know. It's why you read the scholars, and they will tell you that no one knows for certain how to pronounce the name, and so that the Jews, out of reverence for the name, don't say it. And you read that, and you read that in 90% of the scholastic sites.
Oh,
and if you're not a thinking individual, you might accept that.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that not pronouncing a name, not saying a name, doesn't show reverence for the name. It shows a disdain for the name. And the name is written with four letters that are part of the 22 letters that comprise every word in Hebrew.
Uh-huh.
Every other name in Hebrew and every other word in Hebrew that contains those four letters is pronounceable.
What do you say all the time? Can you say shalom?
Yeah, can you say shalom? Doesn't that tell you how to pronounce the waw? And the most common verb in Hebrew, the single most common verb in Hebrew, is the basis of Yahweh's name. He says, my name is based on the verb haya, which means to be,
to exist.
I was, I am, I will be. It's the single most repeated Hebrew verb. It doesn't it tell you how to pronounce these? It's hey, yod, hey. Uh-huh. So doesn't it tell you how to pronounce the ya, hi, ya? What part of this is difficult? How many people question the pronunciation of Torah?
I haven't run across anybody yet.
Yes. Does anybody bother to think how you get the O sound in Torah and how the ah sound at the end of Torah comes from? It's the wah and the hey?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be taught and guided as to how to pronounce Yahweh's name, wouldn't you go to the Hebrew word that Yahweh says means teaching and guidance? If you're looking for directions, why not go to the word that means directions? That's what Torah means. And Torah provides the pronunciation for three of the four letters in Yahweh's name. The only one that it doesn't provide the insights for is the letter that is the one without dispute, the Yod that begins the name, because it's in every name you can imagine, including the name of the children of Yisrael, the Yehudim, and the name Yisrael.
Yeah, well, they didn't run around saying, I'm the nameless people.
Yeah. It was even in Yosha's name, of course.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I am the nameless God.
Yeah, we're the nameless people.
Yeah, we are the nameless
God
people.
Running around this Midbar.
Yeah. So I want to tell you, if you wanted to demonstrate that we're crazy in this, go research a scholar. In fact, research 100 scholars, and you're going to find they all are in lockstep. They all tell you what we have just shared.
Uh-huh.
And then go away. Don't think about it. And you'll be able to dismiss everything we say.
Uh-huh.
But if you think, you take a moment to scratch beneath the surface.
Wait a minute. Yeah.
So we're considering the four words that tell us everything we need to know. A wonderful summation of the Torah. And matter of fact, Kirk, I would say that there is something vastly superior to knowing. And that's understanding. And really the only difference between knowing and understanding is the perspective from which you view that which you've come to know.
Sure.
And it seems to me that the letters that comprise these Hebrew words, the picture that they paint, provides a perspective that provides all of the understanding we need to know who Yahweh is, what he wants, what he's offering,
mm-hmm.
how we are going to engage with him, what all of this is about, why the universe was even created,
mm-hmm.
are depicted in these letters that comprise these three words plus a name.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree.
And also, you know, first with Dabar, we learned that this is the doorway into the most important home, to be part of the family of God, so long as we are observant, we pay attention.
Right.
And then we have Yahweh's name, and we have him depicting the role that he plays.
Mm-hmm.
The arm reaching down and out to us with an open hand to lift us up.
And his desire to expand the family.
Right. And then he's got two people that are, they're not down on their knees, perspective again. No, they're standing up.
Standing up.
Reaching up, paying attention to God.
Yeah, he's got a letter that lies down, you know. If he wanted to use it, he could have used it.
Yeah, he does. In fact, he has several that lie down. And one of the most is Nun, which is an important letter. But the Nun is a... this is what I think is just so profound here. Again, perspective. The Nun in Hebrew, Nun, Nun in Hebrew, depending on the way you want to pronounce it.
Mm-hmm.
It is a picture of a sperm. It's a picture of a sperm, you know, 2,500 years before...
anybody knew what
a sperm looked like. But it's a picture of a sperm. And it conveys a child that is being born with a inheritance. So it's the child of the covenant. And you don't see the Nun in Yahweh's name. You see two adults, two people, standing up, reaching up, looking up.
Able to walk.
God, able to walk. So what's the difference between the child and that sperm, all the potential of life, versus the two people in his name that are standing up, engaged, able to walk, and reaching up?
Not just that, they're engaged, they're ready.
Right. And they've grown up.
Mm-hmm. They've grown up, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's a huge difference. I used to view my role with God as a little child. And that's kind of the whole Christian idea, we're just little children.
Oh, yeah.
That's not God's view.
No.
You know, if you look at the size of the arm and hand that reaches down, the yod, versus the size of the two people that are standing up and reaching up to him and walking with him. The Yod, the first letter in his name, is the smallest letter in Hebrew. and the two people standing up, the hays, are the largest letter in Hebrew.
Well, he wants us
to be like him. He wants to empower us, to make us bigger. You know, he wants a relationship with us where we're all individuals. We're all adults. You know, there's aspects of being a kid that are fun.
Sure.
But you know so much more, you know. I think life is so much better as an adult. You know, I don't want to be Yahweh's baby forever. We think Yahweh's going to, I mean, babies are fun. But having a relationship with an adult child, you know, a son or a daughter who is now an adult, I'm going to tell you is infinitely better than having a relationship with them when they were an infant. You can talk with them. You can reason with them. You can go do things together. Yahweh depicted us in his name as adults, as grown children, able to engage with him and do things with him. I think that's a powerful perspective on what he's trying to accomplish. And, of course, the only other letter in Yahweh's name between the two people standing up, reaching up to him, who are clearly Abraham and Sarah, the mother and father of the covenant.
Is the one.
Is the one. It means to increase.
To increase.
To add to. To secure. To enlarge a home and to secure it. Isn't that what Abraham and Sarah did with the covenant?
That was
based on Yahweh's blessing.
To grow the family.
How many hands are there in Yahweh's name?
There are five.
How many terms and conditions are there to the covenant?
Five.
How many benefits?
Five.
Pretty straightforward story, isn't it?